Bonjour et bienvenue à tous. Merci d'être venu à cette conférence qui promet d'être vraiment très éclairante et passionnante pour, en tout cas, tous les gens qui s'intéressent à Confucius. J'ai vraiment le très grand plaisir et c'est un privilège pour moi d'accueillir ici le professeur Julia Murray. Parce que je dois dire que je suis depuis longtemps lectrice de ces travaux et comme toujours pour nos collègues d'outre-Atlantique, c'est une occasion rare enfin d'arriver à les attraper au vol en quelque sorte. Julia a très très aimablement accepté donc de venir nous parler ici au Collège de France. Alors, Julia Murray est professeure émérite d'histoire de l'art, d'études extrême-orientales et d'études religieuses à l'Université du Wisconsin. Et elle est également associée au très prestigieux Fairbanks Center for Chinese Studies à l'Université Harvard. Son parcours est un parcours d'excellence depuis le début, puisque le professeur Murray a été formé à Yale pour ses études de BA et MA, et ensuite à Princeton pour son PhD qu'elle a passé donc sur un Maharaj, un peintre chinois donc d'époque Song. Ensuite, après son avoir obtenu ce doctorat donc à Princeton, Madame Murray s'est engagée en fait dans une activité muséographique, puisqu'elle a été dans une position de conservateur de musée, dans des musées là aussi très 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 prestigieux, comme le Metropolitan Museum of Art, le Freer Gallery of Art et le Harvard University Art Museum. Comme elle nous l'a expliqué tout à l'heure, elle a senti qu'elle avait besoin de prendre un petit peu ses distances par rapport à cette activité muséographique qui comporte une large part d'administration et qui souffre, comme beaucoup de secteurs, de réunionnite. Elle a décidé donc de s'adonner complètement à l'enseignement universitaire, et ce qu'elle a fait donc essentiellement à l'Université du Wisconsin. Donc le professeur Murray est connu pour un certain nombre de publications. Il y a d'abord en fait une sorte de catalogue des collections de la Freer Gallery, ensuite un catalogue également de calligraphie et de peinture contemporaine de la République de Chine, il y a également un ouvrage qui s'intitule Last of the Mandarins, Chinese Calligraphy and Painting, qui est en fait une présentation d'une collection privée, surtout, disons que le livre qui m'a beaucoup marqué, c'est le Mirror of Morality, Chinese Narrative, Illustrative and Confucian Ideology, paru aux presses universitaires de Hawaï à Honolulu en 2007. Qui a vraiment imposé le professeur Murray comme la spécialiste mondiale enfin de l'iconographie confucéenne. S'intéresse beaucoup justement à cet aspect iconographique enfin de la culture confucéenne. Et c'est elle qui a dirigé une grande exposition sur Confucius, His Life and Legacy in Art, donc sa vie et son legs artistique, qui s'est tenue au China Institute Gallery à New York en 2010, et qui, je dois le dire très franchement, dépasse de très loin ce que nous avons essayé de faire au musée Guimet. Enfin, quand je dis nous, c'est pas moi, mais enfin, j'étais un petit peu embrigadée dans cette entreprise. Et vraiment, là, nous avons la grande référence sur Confucius présenté au grand public dans une exposition grand public. Le professeur Murray donc travaille beaucoup en ce moment sur justement la question de la culture visuelle et matérielle associée au culte de Confucius, et en particulier donc la transmission et la circulation de ses portraits, hein, et des illustrations de sa vie. Alors le professeur Murray va s'exprimer en anglais. Mais comme vous allez le voir, il y a beaucoup d'iconographie. Et ensuite, il y aura un temps de questions que vous pouvez poser en français. On essaiera de se débrouiller pour faire passer le message. Donc, professeur Murray. Okay. Alors, peut-être avant que, pour vous donner du courage et accomplir un rituel propre au Collège de France, donc une médaille souvenir. Donc, du Collège de France.
Ah, bonjour à tous. Merci beaucoup, Anne, pour m'inviter à parler aujourd'hui. Je regrette, je ne peux pas présenter en français maintenant, mais j'ai étudié le français beaucoup. Peut-être la prochaine fois. maintenant, en anglais. In some of my recent research, I have been examining ideas and practices related to the veneration of relics in China. And I focus specifically on the veneration of relics as a little recognized aspect of Confucian ideas and practices in China. The teachings of Confucius, as transmitted, developed, and modified by his disciples and later interpreters, are generally understood to be entirely humanistic. Thus, they may seem incompatible with the religious practice of relic veneration. However, the modern conception of Confucianism as a purely secular form of humanism has obscured important aspects of traditional Chinese ideology and practices. Many recent scholars, including Anne Zheng and Thomas Wilson, Deborah Summer, Hoyt Tilman, etc., have broadened our understanding of Confucianism in the pre-modern period, while other scholars such as Philip Clart, Sébastien Bilieu, and Vincent Gusser have brought attention to modern and contemporary aspects that we might call religious. Here I want to examine the position of relics within the Confucian traditions, and have taken much inspiration from Buddhist scholars such as Bernard Faure, John Strong, Kevin Trainer, John Kieschnick, and so forth. I will not be mentioning so many names in the rest of my talk, but I wanted to just give you an idea of some of the work that I have been reading in trying to come up with some definitions that might work in the Confucian context for talking about relics and practices related to them. So I have developed working definitions and typologies for relic-related practices and their material forms in a Confucian milieu. Today I will start by identifying some different types of relic and exploring some early forms of veneration that predate the arrival of Buddhism in China. I will then survey the elements that enabled Confucius' homeland of Chufu, Shandong, to become the most important place for scholarly pilgrims to go pay homage to the relics of Confucius and to benefit from their auspicious aura. Finally, I analyzed the features of a shrine far from Chufu, whose supporters presented it as a microcosm of Chufu, making analogies to the home, temple, and tomb of Confucius. Now, the term relic covers a variety of things by which a devotee can gain connection to a special figure, including through various forms of bodily remains, personal articles, sites of important events, music, and teachings, especially in the form of texts. Many religions consider relics to be direct conduits to spiritual forces, and they treat them as material objects of devotion, which sometimes occupy magnificent reliquaries. In China, relics are most closely identified with Buddhism, a religion that originated in India. The Buddha himself instructed his disciples to divide his bodily remains into 8 portions after his cremation and enshrine them inside of reliquary mounds called stupas, so that worshippers could come and benefit by making offerings to them. Relics also played an important role in spreading his teachings into China and other regions. Relics serve to link particular places and peoples to the life and times of the Buddha and extended his Dharma, or teaching, to places that the Buddha himself never visited. One famous example is finger bone that the Tang official and writer Han Yu denounced in a famous memorial written in the year 819, because the relic was being brought to the emperor with great ceremony for him to worship. It so happens that the relic and all of the nested reliquaries that we see here, one smaller than the next, were found in 1987 in the underground chamber of the Famen Pagoda, the Famense Pagoda. That would be the relic. Now it has been moved to a huge and spectacular reliquary that was built in 2009 near the original Famense, and this place can accommodate an enormous number of pilgrims coming to worship the relics. In addition to cremation ash and related jewel-like particles, the Indian Buddhist discourse on relics also included 2 other major types: relics of use and teaching relics. Relics of use included everyday objects that the Buddha had owned or handled, such as his clothing and begging bowl, which are often called contact relics because he came into direct physical contact with them. Also classified as relics of use are places with which he was closely associated, such as the Bodhi tree under which he achieved enlightenment and the park where he preached his first sermon. Such objects and sites often inspired the construction of shrines and monasteries, which became destinations for pilgrimage. The third category of Buddhist relics, teaching or Dharma relics, includes everything that records the Buddha's message, from brief quotations to whole sutras. The Buddha himself told his closest disciples that his Dharma, his teachings, would replace him after he died, implying that it was the most important of the 3 types of relic. Visual images are sometimes discussed as a 4th type of relic, the commemorative relic, which remind one of, or somehow point to, or represent the Buddha. And indeed, the worship of images and attributing special powers to them were as important in Buddhism's impact on China as was the cult of bodily relics. Relics and images were both capable of working miracles and causing supernatural events. Until recently, such distinctly religious elements have not been part of our conception of Confucianism, or Rujiao. Confucius and his later interpreters, who have developed his ideas, have generally been associated with purely secular and humanistic concerns, particularly individual learning and moral cultivation, as well as with principles of governance and social harmony. However, successive Chinese dynasties maintained an official cult of sacrifices to Confucius, his disciples, and later interpreters, at which they made offerings of wine, meat, vegetables, incense, and silk, along with solemn prayers, ceremonial hymns, and ritual dance. Emperors also awarded posthumous ranks and honors to Confucius and his followers, and they were ever more noble and high status until the year 1530, when the Jiajing Emperor, the Ming Jiajing Emperor, decided that these were not appropriate and changed Confucius' title to Ultimate Sage and First Teacher, the Zhishan Xianshi, which is the title on this particular image. Confucianism does not give a large role to body relics, but the concepts of contact relics, teaching relics, and commemorative relics are congenial to it. The teaching relic fits especially well with long-standing Chinese tendencies to identify doctrines and texts with their authors. Emperors repeatedly gave the Confucian classics monumental form by having the text carved on large stone tablets. And we see here the earliest example, the Xiping stone classics from the later 2nd century AD, existing only in small fragments now, but still some words are readable. And much more recent, the 18th century Qianlong period set that is still largely intact and can be seen in Beijing at the Guozijian, the site right next to the Temple of Confucius. Educated men internalized these teaching relics of Confucius by memorizing the texts. As for contact relics and other kinds of relics of use, devotees sometimes attributed spiritual power to objects and places that had an association with Confucius and other revered figures in his tradition. The Chinese term most commonly used for these kinds of relics is ji, which is usually translated into English as traces. And these were venerated in distinctive ways. Perhaps the most important conceptual difference from Buddhist practice is that the purpose of Confucian veneration is to stimulate moral cultivation and benefit society, rather than to gain personal blessings or merit toward salvation. The idea of associating great figures of the past with their traces is very old, and it comes up in the Shijing Classic of Poetry, one of the books that Confucius is said to have compiled and edited from much older sources. In the Shijing, there is a short poem called Gantang, or Sweet Pear Tree, which is often quoted in commemorative inscriptions at shrines for worthy officials. The poem calls for protecting a tree associated with the Earl of Shao, the Shaobo, who is a revered leader who had stood under this tree. And I don't know that I should particularly read this translation because it's pretty simple. In English, we just call it a ditty. It's just a very simple poem. But the point is that the tree is not to be harmed simply because this great leader from past time had once sheltered under it. Traces were sometimes invisible or intangible. For Confucius himself, even music could function as a relic because the ancient sage rulers who had played this music or had it performed for them became vividly present to him when he heard certain pieces. Intangible traces could be given form by means of a commemorative inscription on a stone tablet called a stele. For example, the place where Confucius supposedly heard the Shao music of Emperor Shun and forgot the taste of meat for 3 months afterward. The place was marked with a stele, which was replaced several times over the centuries. A place where an admirable person had done something might become a site for venerating him or her in later times, perhaps with a shrine. Literate visitors would expect to be inspired to ponder the past while reflecting on the person's deeds and character. And this kind of observance has not gone entirely out of style. A few years ago, the scholar-photographer Meng Qingji undertook a personal quest which lasted a couple of years, to retrace Confucius' travels on foot and to document each place in his photographs. So he published books and had several exhibitions, all on this pilgrimage of his. Now, the worship of Confucius originated in Chufu, his hometown, and at first was located around his grave, which is illustrated here in a 17th century edition of the gazetteer called Cheli Zhi, the record of the history, rituals, and people associated with the cult of Confucius in Chufu. The Han grand historian Sima Qian says that sacrifices at Confucius' grave began with the local ruler, Duke Ai of Lu, shortly after Confucius died in about 479 BC. The closest disciples remained at the grave to mourn Confucius for 3 years, and one of them, the disciple Zugong, built a hut and stayed 3 additional years. Many disciples and others in the region moved their homes to be close to the grave, forming a settlement that came to be known as Kung Village, or Kung Li, after the surname of Confucius, Kungzi. When Sima Qian himself visited at the end of the first century BC, the cemetery had enlarged to an area of about, in English, it would be 14 acres, one qing, and I don't know what that would be in hectares, but something smaller, I think, implying that a considerable number of descendants and devotees had come to be buried near him. Indeed, if you look really hard at this plan, you can see that there are other graves that are marked of descendants, all identified. This is the grave of Confucius himself that I've highlighted in yellow. The disciples are said to have brought trees from their native places to the cemetery, causing many species to grow there, and they say that this is still the case. The remains of the Chinese pistache, the kaimu, allegedly planted by the faithful Zugong, is still to be seen near Confucius' grave. We see the stump of it over here, the stele, refreshed in modern time, I dare say. You can see it was once just damaged, I think, in the Cultural Revolution, and it has its own stone pagoda. The grave of Confucius himself was embellished and rebuilt many times over the centuries and up to the present. The basic elements that we see today, however, were in place by the 12th century. There's a spirit way leading to an offering hall in front of a tomb mound that was furnished with a stone stele, as well as an altar and incense burners. So this is the spirit way here, with animals and figures lining it, the offering hall behind, and then beyond is the grave and markers. Sima Qian also notes that the former residence of Confucius had been turned into a temple, and there his clothing, his zither, carriage, and his writings were preserved. In 195 BC, the Han Emperor Gaozu offered a large beast sacrifice there, a Tai Lao sacrifice, the grandest kind. And this imperial recognition marked a major milestone in the evolution of the cult of Confucius. This event is included in most versions of the illustrated biography of Confucius and is clearly very important. This is one from the 16th century. And take note of the personal articles, the zither, the hat, the robe, a book, anachronistic in its Ming binding, I might mention, at the sacrifice. Sima Qian's description makes it clear that Chufu had already become a place for a special kind of pilgrimage by the Han Dynasty, which was about 4 centuries after the lifetime of Confucius. Sima Qian notes that lesser nobles and ministers often visited there before taking up official posts in the region. And in the postscript to his own biography of Confucius, Sima Qian writes of his own pilgrimage to Chufu in terms that suggest a very deep emotional connection. Quoting a line from the Shujing, he says he looked up at Confucius as if to a lofty mountain and aspired to follow this model. When he read Confucius' writings, he imagined he could see Confucius himself. When he came to the temple hall and contemplated the master's robe, cap, zither, and carriage, he was so moved he could hardly tear himself away to leave. As he observes in his conclusion, although Confucius had been a commoner, 10 generations of scholars had treated him as their ancestor, and even emperors and kings considered him their master. He concludes by affirming that Confucius should indeed be called the ultimate sage. Sima Qian's experience in turn became a model for educated men of later times who would have been well aware of Sima Qian's pilgrimage from studying his monumental history, the Shiji. Moreover, the detailed chronology of Confucius' life helped to confer significance on the places that were associated with specific events or teachings. It is no coincidence that the 15th century compiler of the first pictorial biography used Sima Qian's text to order the scenes and quoted excerpts from the text to annotate them. We see this text over in the far right here. This is the quotation from the Shiji, and this is a sort of a poem of praise that the compiler composed in order to celebrate the event, and he did that for each of about 30 events. Several other sites in the Chufu region that became stops on the scholarly pilgrim's itinerary are also illustrated in the Gazetteer of Cheli, or the Cheli Zhi. A convenient overview appears under the title, Picture of the State of Lu. Using the name of the ancient state where Confucius had lived and sought to serve. The most significant places also have their own illustrations, one of which I just showed, namely the cemetery containing the graves of Confucius and his descendants, and that appears here, as well as the Great Temple, which I will discuss in a moment. A short distance from Chufu is Nishan, or Mount Ni, a very scenic location, even today, that was associated with his birth. Sima Qian wrote that Confucius' mother made an offering to pray for a son at Nichou, meaning Ni Hill, and the baby was born with a slight depression in the top of his head that resembled the hill, so was given the personal name Qiu. Other sources claim that Confucius was born in a cave there, and it's a cave that can still be visited. There it is today. This is a map of Nishan or Nichou. Apocryphal stories preserved by Confucius' descendants include supernatural details that also became part of the landscape, such as the Five Old Men Peak, which refers to the celestial apparition of five old men representing the essence of stars on the night before the birth of Confucius. This picture shows the shrine and academy that was built at Nishan in later centuries to commemorate all of these events. And there's even a shrine to the spirit of the mountain who supposedly answered the prayer of Confucius' mother. The Sung Emperor Renzong ennobled this spirit in 1050 with the title the Marquis who engendered the sage. And I can show some of these now on this plan. There's the cave. It's now called just Fuzidong, or Master's Cave. In the imperial period, it was called Kunlingdong, or the Efficacy of the Feminine Principle Cave. Kind of interesting. Here's the shrine to the spirit of Nishan, and over here, the academy that was built and the temple to Confucius and his father. Reverential visitors who came to Chufu to experience the spirit of Confucius in his home region invariably went to the Great Temple itself. And a very good book has recently come out in English on this temple by James Flath, simply called Traces of the Sage. In any case, by the mid-18th century, the temple had become almost as grand as the imperial palace. The rubbing on the left suggests its configuration soon after the facilities were rebuilt following a fire in 1724. And the reconstruction was largely financed by the Yongzheng Emperor, who sent imperial artisans to help with the project. The visitor enters the temple through a series of ceremonial gates and proceeds northward along the main axis. And the archways are all inscribed with inspirational phrases from Confucian texts that are written in monumental imperial calligraphy, such as you might be able to see here. It's a little bit dim, I'm afraid, with the lights on. An immense number of inscribed stone stelae stand further along, some of them protected under stelae pavilions, which we're looking at the roofs of here. And on this plan, they're along there. There was also a library where Confucian texts were held here. Nowadays, the books have been taken away, but the building still stands. Stelae inscriptions were contributed by emperors, officials, private scholars, etc., over a period of many centuries. Some of them record the temple's history. Others record liturgies or other events that are specific to a particular time, but many of them simply express veneration to Confucius and the way of the ancient sages that he transmitted. The scholar official who wrote this particular stone stele, which simply reads Xingtan, or apricot altar, signs his name in an interesting way. He calls himself a Munsheng, or a pupil of Confucius, even after so many centuries had passed by the time he came in the late 13th, early 14th century. The so-called apricot altar, or the Xingtan, was actually built in the year 1022 to mark the supposed site where Confucius had lectured to his disciples after coming back from his travels on the unsuccessful quest for a position. He retired back to his home state, and for the last several years of his life, he gathered more and more followers and disciples and gave them lectures. In 1022, this was a time when there was a restoration of the descendants and their observance of the cult of Confucius, and they finally received attention from the Sung Emperor at the beginning of the 11th century. So this apricot altar was part of a sort of major construction project. So they wanted to celebrate that place very specifically. And initially, the apricot altar consisted just of three open-air tiers of brick or tile, which is shown in this illustration. And this is an illustration that was added to one of the several genealogies of the Kung descendants in the later part of the Sung dynasty. In this plan, we see that same apricot altar. Oops, sorry, I pressed the wrong thing. Right here, the open-air three-tiered structure. In another successive edition of the genealogy, in which the author is basically showing how things have gotten so much better by his time, because now the apricot altar has a pavilion over it, a little bit hard to see, right here. And it becomes very grand indeed under the Qing dynasty, the last of the Chinese dynasties. The Qianlong emperor, who was so devoted to the cult of Confucius that he visited Chufu something like six times, adding more inscriptions each time, he had a commemorative stele added to it with his own eulogy on the apricot altar, or the Xingtanzan. And that is this one right here. Now, the trees near the apricot altar were also significant relics because people believe that Confucius had planted them. They are shown on this 13th century plan in a kind of schematic form. But later on, they're illustrated in a fuller form. The 8th century writer Feng Yan says that the trees had died when northern invaders had conquered China's heartland in the year 309. But the trees revived in 601 after the Sui dynasty restored native rule. The 13th century temple plan depicts them schematically in the overview, but they also are given their own page of illustration in the same book, where they have the hieratic appearance of an icon, or as an 18th century writer later noted, the three legs of a tripod, which is sort of a symbol of dynastic legitimacy. In other words, the flourishing, withering, and successive revivals of the trees were interpreted as responses to the moral condition of society and to events that affected the status of Confucius' teachings as well as the temple's well-being. Particular attention has focused on a cypress tree, which was also the only tree that continued to survive after the Mongol Yuan dynasty. It has been celebrated for reflecting heavenly principle and is revered as a physical link to Confucius himself. Scholar officials were inspired to compose eulogies in its honor, such as one by the famous Sung calligrapher Mi Fu, written in 1103, which was incised on a stele that formerly stood next to the tree, but was later replaced by the rather prosaic Ming stele. The tree's symbolic importance is emphasized by its giant size on this 17th century temple plan from the expanded edition of the Cheli Jur, as we see up here. And it's even included in some expanded versions of the pictorial biography of Confucius. The accompanying text here asserts that the tree responds to imminent changes in the heavenly mandate to rule. It describes how the tree anticipated the rise of the Ming dynasty by sprouting again and returning to life many decades after apparently being destroyed by fire early in the Mongol period. It revived again in the year 1640 on the eve of the Qing conquest, the dynasty under which this edition of the Life of Confucius was published. Now, the upper left photo in this slide was included in the Journal of the Confucius Religion Association, the Kungjiahui Zazhi, in the early 19-teens, after the Republican President Yuan Shikai reinstated sacrifices to Confucius that the Republic had initially stopped performing. Even though it's probably too small to see, the caption to the illustration notes that the tree had burned in a catastrophic fire at the turn of the 16th century, but a new tree had later sprouted beside the trunk inside the railing. However, this hopeful sign seems to be negated in the lower left photograph, which is published 2 decades later by a Japanese sinologist who spent years in Chufu studying the physical traces of Confucius and the cult. There is no tree in his photograph, and he writes with evident disappointment that the tree was dead. But in recent years, there is again a cypress tree there, which we see on the right, and the restored Ming stele claims that it is the very one planted by Confucius' own hand. Across the courtyard from the tree, there stands the magnificent sacrificial hall, the ceremonial heart of the temple, whose outer columns are carved with dragons in high relief. You can see a little bit of that there. And inside, panels with gilded calligraphy of Ming and Qing emperors quote phrases from the Confucian classics in praise of Confucius. And again, dragon motifs appear in the panels of the coffered ceiling, adding to the imperial ambiance. But the most noteworthy feature is that the ornate niches display large sculptural icons representing Confucius, the four correlates, and the 12 savants, the most major followers. And here is the statue of Confucius as it looked until the Cultural Revolution. However, after a major ritual reform in the year 1530, Confucian temples in general were required to replace their images with inscribed tablets. The Chufu temple was given an exception because it was also the family ancestral temple of the Kung lineage of Confucius' descendants. His icon displays the attributes of a king, reflecting his posthumous title from the Tang period until the 1530 reform. The building that most explicitly collects the traces of Confucius is the Hall of the Sage's Traces, or the Shengji Dian, built in 1592 at the north end of the central axis of the temple. As is appropriate to Confucius' identity as a teacher, it is a single-story building with a green tiled roof rather than the double-roofed golden tile, which is the palatial style. And in that sense, it contrasts quite a bit with the grand sacrificial hall. Incide, three incised stones are installed at the center of the north wall here, reproducing venerated portraits of Confucius that allegedly had been transmitted through the generations of his descendants. And they are flanked by a pictorial hagiography, I think is the word for it. It's even grander than a biography, consisting of 112 incised stones illustrating events of Confucius' life and the development of his posthumous cult. This is just a detail of part of that. The dedicatory inscription at the end, of which this is just a detail, says that the stones were erected by the 60th generation of the sage's disciples so that people could have an audience with the sage, even if only by means of rubbings. All of these pictorial tablets are very worn because so many visitors took rubbings from them. Above is the monumental inscription honoring Confucius as the teacher model for 10,000 ages, or the Wanshi Shibiao, which the Kangxi Emperor wrote when he went to Chufu in the year 1684 and performed a sacrifice to Confucius there. The calligraphy was subsequently carved on stone, and rubbings were distributed around the empire. I might mention that only a couple of years ago, the National Palace Museum in Taiwan had an exhibition at which they unveiled what they believed to be the original Kangxi brush-written calligraphy, as you see here. The east wall of the Shengji Dian has many other stone stelae, most of them carved with imperial tributes, particularly by the Kangxi and Qianlong emperors, and occupy massive stones along this east wall. While the west wall has smaller stone tablets carved with assorted portraits of Confucius that were mostly based on Kung family heirloom pictures. Other buildings within the Chufu temple complex reflect its association with the Kung line of descendants, such as the grand resting hall, as it's called, the Qindian, with the spirit tablet of Confucius' wife just behind the main sacrificial hall. On the eastern axis is the family temple, the Jiamiao, and that was used solely for the Kung lineage's private worship, where Confucius and his wife were worshipped as founding ancestors. And there are no images here. The other ancestors that are worshipped there are Confucius' son, grandson, and 43rd generation descendant, known as the Restoration Ancestor, who had saved the family line from extinction in the 10th century. The wives of these men are also included in the family temple rites, which is a major difference from the official cult of Confucius. Next to the temple is the Kung Mansion, or the Kung Fu, with facilities for senior lineage descendants to live and work. And it too displays many emblems of imperial homage to China's first family, as they like to call themselves. Kung descendants had gained official recognition in the Han period as caretakers of the cemetery and temple in Chufu, and they conducted sacrifices to benefit the entire realm. Emperors of successive dynasties generously patronized them by awarding noble titles, lands, stipends, servant households, and tax and labor exemptions. As lineal descendants, they were in effect the living relics of Confucius, and their presence helped to distinguish Chufu as the Confucian holy land. By contrast, other Confucian temples did not include roles for the Kungs and their family cult. Soon after the fall of the Han Dynasty, sacrifices began being offered at the Imperial University in the capital. And in the 7th century, temples were set up along with government schools in provincial and prefectural centers as part of the civil service examination system. Students and officials were supposed to offer a major sacrifice to Confucius twice a year. This is a very typical late imperial example of such a government school and associated temple, the school. So back here we have the hall of the revered classics and the sacrificial area. The school part is over here, but there is absolutely nothing for Kung descendants. After the Jajang Emperor's major reform of state ritual in 1530, temples associated with government schools were not allowed to have anthropomorphic icons in the sacrificial hall. They only had inscribed tablets with the names and honorific titles for Confucius, disciples, and later individuals who had been canonized. Although many temples and schools also possessed an incised stone replica of a lifelike portrait of Confucius to inspire students and officials in daily life, it was displayed in another building. Only the Chufu Temple was allowed to keep representational images in the sacrificial hall because of its dual function as both an official and Kung family ancestral temple. So to summarize, Chufu possessed all kinds of relics of Confucius, from the tomb with his body, supposedly, to things and places associated with him in life, and assorted images and representations of his deeds. There was also the library containing his teachings and a multitude of commemorative texts expressing venerations. Now we come to the rather curious story of Kung Jai, a place that purported to be a microcosm of Chufu. It is situated near Shanghai in a small hamlet far from Chufu, where Confucius never went, but was said to possess Confucius' robe and cap. In a Buddhist context, these intimate contact relics would signify the transmission of spiritual or doctrinal authority. According to local traditions about Kung Jai that were first documented in the late 12th century, several descendants of Confucius had lived in the area, and a 34th generation descendant had buried these personal articles, along with a few jade ornaments, in the year 606 AD. Although the relics themselves were never seen, a stone-faced mound called the Tomb of the Robe and Cap, the Iguan Mu, was built there in the 17th century to mark their presence. This tomb and a sacrificial hall in front of it formed the core of a shrine to Confucius that was not part of the official temple network, and its patrons repeatedly claimed that the clothing had brought Confucius' efficacious spirit, his Ling Qi, to a place that he never even visited in his lifetime. Confucius was also made present in Kung Jai in other forms. His sculptural effigy was enshrined at the center of the sacrificial hall, accompanied by statues of the four correlates, all copied from counterparts in the Chufu Temple. Other buildings housed various portraits of Confucius incised on stone steles, ultimately based on paintings handed down by descendants in Chufu. One of them had been brought to Kung Jai in 1669, after suddenly appeared in a nearby marsh and revealed its presence with mysterious lights flashing over it. There were also two sets of incised stone tablets describing and depicting events from the life of Confucius, which were both put on display at Kung Jai in the year 1682, under rather different titles, as you see here. One was simply called Pictures of the Traces of the Sage, Confucius, and the other, more elaborately, Pictures of the Great Completer, Ultimate Sage, and Exalted First Teacher of Culture, Traveling Around. The Traces of the Sage, Confucius, depicts selected events from Sima Qian's textual biography of Confucius in a plain and archaic style, and that's the one up on the top there. And there's relatively little attention to details of settings and furnishings. And in fact, it was copied from an earlier version created elsewhere in 1444. The other set of pictures was newly commissioned, and it reimagined Confucius' life with a more luxurious and contemporary ambiance of 17th century Jiangnan, as well as adding a few episodes from texts other than Sima Qian Shiji. The more archaic looking version ends with the Han Dynasty emperor's sacrifice in Chufu, which somewhat awkwardly shows Confucius' robe and cap on the altar up here. Nonetheless, commemorative inscriptions written for these pictures assert that they brought the ancient events to life and enabled viewers to feel that they had joined the company of disciples in the master's presence. One sponsor calls them medicinal stones to awaken the mind, meaning that they could stimulate the viewer in a way that would enable him to advance in moral cultivation. The other version ends with a scene of the disciples mourning at the grave mound, avoiding the question of what happened to his clothes and cap. The only accompanying inscription is by the magistrate who sponsored this set of carvings. Finally, a now lost set of stone tablets at Kungjai represented Confucius through teachings associated with him in the form of a complete transcription of the classical filial piety, the Xiaojing, which was based on a brush-written original by the great Ming calligrapher Dong Zhichang. The work later entered the Qing Palace collection and was reproduced in the Qianlong Emperor's Compendium of Model Calligraphy in the Hall of Three Rarities, from which we can get a sense of what the carved version at Kungjai might have looked like. Near the end of the 17th century, Kungjai's patron succeeded in gaining an endorsement from the senior Kung descendant in Chufu, the Duke for Perpetuating the Sage, who wrote a commemorative inscription to carve on a stele and have it erected at Kungjai. And the next duke designated a local branch of Kungs to attend to routine sacrifices at Kungjai. In 1705, the Kangxi Emperor stopped by on his fifth southern inspection tour and awarded calligraphy that certified Kungjai's legitimacy. During the following decade, a tower of imperial calligraphy was built to house the emperor's ink originals, as well as stone tablets that were made to carve to reproduce them. And a variety of other structures reflected Kungjai's new importance and surge in patronage, including things like the library, bigger main hall, multiple stele pavilions, and very significantly down here, a commemorative arch that is inscribed Little Cueli or Xiao Cueli. And that is a direct reference to Chufu and claiming that the place is the microcosm of Chufu. Kungjai thus purports to offer the visitor an experience comparable to that of Chufu, but the patrons were never able to gain official credentials and reliable funding in the form of lands devoted to the maintenance of Kungjai. And in fact, the Kangxi Emperor's successors, the Yongzheng and Qianlong Emperors, either ignored Kungjai or perhaps actively suppressed it as an unorthodox local cult, quite in contrast to their generous patronage of Chufu. Kungjai was virtually destroyed in the Taiping Rebellion and built more modestly afterward, as shown in this site plan, which was published in a much-delayed update of the County Gazetteer. In 1914, members of the Confucius Religion Society, Kongjiahui, held a major celebration of Confucius' birthday here because unsettled conditions made it difficult to go to Chufu. But otherwise, Kungjai remained relatively little known. An old photograph taken around that time shows the arch. Can't quite see that it says Xiao Cueli, but presumably it does. And even this rather raggedy remains was destroyed in the Cultural Revolution and not rebuilt. So only two ginkgo trees survive at the site. So to wind things up, I would say the teachings of Confucius were unquestionably his most important relics. They were transmitted without geographic limit in the texts of the Confucian classics, and a major mode of venerating was through proper performance of the sacrifice to Confucius and his canonized followers, which took place in Confucius' temples throughout the realm at specified intervals. Ideally, the experience would stimulate participants to renew their own commitment to the way, which they had internalized by memorizing the classics and cultivating their moral character. The display and circulation of portraits and hagiographical pictures aided in this process, although critics sometimes argued that visual representations fostered only a superficial understanding. The ultimate ideal was to transmit and practice the way. So physical relics associated with Confucius played subsidiary roles in his veneration, and compared with his teachings, got far less attention from scholars and officials who operated his cult. Nonetheless, the material aspects of his identification with Chufu endowed his home region with special charisma. Chufu had the grave supposedly containing his body, various objects he had used during life, and many sites associated with his words and deeds. Furthermore, it harbored the senior line of his flesh and blood descendants who shared his essence and represented an ostensibly continuous connection to him. Charged with maintaining his temple and tomb, the Kungs made themselves an integral part of the Chufu mystique, a phenomenon without obvious counterpart in other religions. For ordinary literati who were steeped in Confucian learning, a visit to Chufu offered complete immersion in the master's aura and the potential for a spiritual renewal. For emperors, although few made the pilgrimage in person and more bestowed patronage from afar, attention to Chufu also affirmed political legitimacy and publicly endorsed orthodox principles of governance. Material forms of Confucian veneration include dedicatory steles, commemorative archways, building signboards, calligraphic couplets, transcriptions of texts, compositions of eulogies, and poetry perhaps, and the act of taking rubbings from carved versions of all of the above. Kung Jai represents a rare case in which the presumed presence of contact relics and local lore concerning the dwelling of Kung descendants in antiquity combined to serve as a pretext for constructing a shrine to Confucius. Its patrons asserted that the presence of relics had brought Confucius to this place he never visited in life and caused auspicious or even miraculous events to occur in the vicinity. The presence of relics was further credited with enabling the South in general to attain a cultural level greater than or equal to that of the North, and for the local Sungjiang Prefecture in particular to become superior to other localities within the Jiangnan region, most notably referring to Suzhou. Nonetheless, Kung Jai rarely aroused more than local interest, suggesting that unseen relics, assorted images, and obscure descendants could not create a fully persuasive aura to attract wider attention to a place Confucius never went. Thank you.